member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Clancy?
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy.
I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be. And I may not be again sometime, because some awful good guys and women who have been in AA have forgotten the maintenance of their spiritual condition. I noticed one of the deaf guys has already left. That's kind of amazing, isn't it? I haven't hardly said anything yet. Well, maybe the guy broke his finger. Well, I don't know. I don't ever take pictures in an AA meeting. Ever. Ever. That is an absolute violation of our traditions. I don't mind. I like to have my picture taken. But you must not take a picture in an AA meeting. You might drive somebody out who's afraid their picture is going to be taken. True story. But anyway, now that we've got taken care of that, is there anybody else I can offend back there? Let's see. I've enjoyed the convention. I got here a little bit late to hear Robert last night. I'm sorry I missed him, but I've known Robert for a great many years, and I could piece together all the wisdom he had. I talked to him, I rubbed against him, and I felt a glow in my elbow, so I know it was all right. And listening to Frog this morning, gave a good talk, identified with him. I'm an old Navy guy from two wars before him, but we're still in the Navy. And Margaret this afternoon with her delightful story, and sad, but with a nice ending. And here are Al-Anon tonight, who sounds more alcoholic than all the rest of them. Except they had to recover or get drunk. She didn't have to do that. It's nice when you can be alcoholic and not have to do anything about it. Just, you all shape up, you sons of bitches. I'll release you. And I'm sure we'll have a good meeting tomorrow morning. I was interested in seeing the program. There's one little other thing. I might as well offend the management of the convention just a little bit. I notice we have a spiritual meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. Let me give you a little piece of advice. Every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual meeting. The morning you have it doesn't make any difference at all. The Wednesday afternoon spiritual meeting, Wednesday afternoon AA meeting is just as spiritual as the Sunday morning AA meeting. And we sometimes, because we get used to going to church on Sunday morning, we think Sunday morning meetings are spiritual meetings, but they're not. Those are just AA meetings where AAs are speaking. And if it's not that, then it's not an AA meeting. So we don't, I don't need your stinking approval. I'm giving you facts. For some reason or other, I have never been able to get along very well with people. Although I must say I was doing pretty well here last night. I met some new friends and was really doing well till I asked them what convention they were with. It looked like girls to me. I thought I was making my move pretty easily. And then I also see we have a meeting of the codependency and ACOA folks also going on here. Walking down this hall this afternoon about 2 o'clock, there was a meeting going on. I'm not ridiculing at all. It's just something. So they have a little different program than we have. There was a meeting at it was just starting. I was interested. The door was open because the title outside, they have the list of the title at 12 o'clock. This is the 2 o'clock one. It's called Dreams. And there was a sister, a Catholic sister apparently, who was giving a talk on dreams. And she was saying, now during this talk, we're going to have your piece of paper and pencil. And usually when you're really focused on yourself, you're not able to talk. But maybe from time to time, you can, as you focus on yourself, still be able to make a note. And I thought to myself, well, I wish you all well, and I'm glad you're not like me, because if I focused on myself for 2 hours, I'd commit suicide. I wouldn't do it. There's a whole nation today, it seems like, who is into what would appear to me to be victimization. And victimization is it really is a big fad, ranging from the various upset from a child to the repressed memory syndrome, which has become almost a national disgrace, where these people are suddenly remembering memories and putting people in jail that later on they say, oh, I guess it didn't really happen, but it's a little bit late then, and ruining lives. And I'm sure that there's some of this is true, but I can't believe that all of these things, satanic rituals and all these things, suddenly all happened since a new group of amateur psychologists start inducing memories in people's minds. But I'm familiar with victimization. I lived with it for a lot of years. When I was a young man, I had a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings, as I have had all my life. But then I felt that they were probably rectifiable. So I went to my knowledge, because I've always had the feeling, if I can just find out what's wrong with me, I'll be all right. And I've spent thousands of dollars and years of my life seeking to get to the reasons for all these emotions I have. And I have found out the reasons in a couple different therapies. I found different sets of reasons, but they seem to be correct as far as I could tell. I remember in psychoanalysis, I became aware that I was not sufficiently loved or nurtured as a child, as we heard a little while ago from our Al-Anon speaker, and I believe that's true, and that my grandparents didn't really love me as well as they loved some of the other kids, although I guess they did, but that I had been warped by the depression. I'd lived in a poor family, and I remember living in a poor family. I must say, in all honesty, I didn't know we were poor, because everybody was poor. When everybody's poor, nobody's poor. But when you want to look back and look with sadness, yes, I was poor. I didn't have a bicycle. I didn't have a lot of things. I didn't have, as though other people had them. Other people didn't have them either. But when you're feeling sorry for yourself, that extraneous. I found a number of reasons. I found that, for example, when I was about 8 years old, I was in third grade, and I could read fast. And I was very fast and omnivorous reader. And they didn't know what to do with me, because I'd read fast and get done quickly. So they shoved me ahead a year and a half in school, which is what you did then. I guess, I don't think they do now. They send them to special classes or overachievers class, whatever the hell they do them. But I mean, then they just shoved you ahead. And I think that's valid. Remember the psychiatrist pointing out to me that it was caused a great, an ongoing problem in my life, because I'd gone from being a kind of a fitting in captain of the softball team, regular member of the class who could read fast, into a year and a half later, a small kid from a previous grade who nobody wanted to play with really because he was too little, and who never did fit in, and who had to keep start being a smart aleck and showing off to prove that I was equal. I did that for years and years without even being aware of it. And I think that's a valid reason for some of my emotions. He pointed out to me that my parents divorced when I was about 11 or 12. Divorce to young people today doesn't seem like much, but I'd never even heard of a divorce. There are no divorces in my little town that I knew of, certainly not in our church, Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I couldn't believe that my parents were getting divorced. And yet, instinctively, without missing a beat, I've never had seen a divorce, I instinctively went right through the jugular. I did exactly the wrong thing. If I could have been trained for 4 years, I couldn't have done it any better. Without even being missing a beat, to instinctively begin to play mother against father once they were separated. When father insisted on discipline, I'd go to mother and say, Mother, Dad has been saying terrible things about you, and I'd want to live with him. And when mother would give me discipline, I'd go to father and say, Mother's been saying terrible things about you, I'd want to live with her. And if they both ever got together, I'd go live, tell grandma that they both were no good. And I think it's safe to say that I efficiently rid myself of any continuing discipline at probably the most critical period of my life, when I should be getting structure. My body was changing, my mind was changing, and here I was, a smart aleck, a mouthy kid trying to prove something without structure. I'll tell you, I found myself in my 30s still learning things that I should have learned when I was 13 or 14. And by the time I was 15, I was a screwed up kid. Once upon a time, I'd been a straight A student. Now I was flunking out of high school. But the Second World War had just started relatively recently. And one day I told my mother I was going to go to Superior, Wisconsin, and visit my aunt. Instead, I hitchhiked to San Francisco and lied my age. The day before my 16th birthday, I was in Pearl Harbor. I don't know if it was patriotism or neurosis or goofiness, but the psychiatrist pointed out to me that created a lot of scars on you. You were a dumb little kid out in the middle of a war. You know, I hadn't even been to Milwaukee yet, and here I was in Pearl Harbor. And it did create a lot of scars on me. And as the merchant marine, later in the war, I got old enough, I went in the Navy. And I had a terrible time there. But I went to psychoanalysis, and I learned a lot of these things. And I learned about how what seemed to me to be a terrible thing, impregnating a girl in college and having to marry her, had changed my philosophy towards life, and all sorts of things. And in psychoanalysis, I spent thousands of dollars, and I got to the root of a lot of problems. I really got to the root of a lot of problems. And I can tell you that if you go to psychoanalysis or other therapies, you can begin to see that you have really been hurt by forces beyond your control, that your life is warped, kind of, and that you should have been something. And you develop a resentment towards people who should have treated you better. And the only thing wrong with this is this. All of this knowledge doesn't help you. You just wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. The only possible use I ever thought of, I never tried it, but it seems reasonable. You might have the story like that some night late in a bar where some guy comes over and says, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" Well, I wasn't sufficiently nurtured as a child in my perfect. Not really the type of data they're interested in. But I was a victim for a number of years, and I a lot of times, for this and other reasons, I have sat around and felt sad. An illustration I've used sometimes, I hadn't thought about it for a while, is I remember telling why I felt rejected. Most of my life, I've always felt very easily rejected. I can see rejection where nobody can see rejection. I can hear it in a tone of voice. When I'm at the top of my game, I can see it in a passing memo. Just, I know they're after me again, those bastards. But I was wondering why I had this sense of rejection. I began, we isolated when I was a little boy. My parents were both teachers, and they had to go to different parts of Wisconsin to teach in the Depression. And I had to live with my grandparents. And my grandparents, you know, I was their only grandchild for hundreds of miles, and they were both from Norway, and I was the only one they had knew with their last name. In fact, I am the last. My son is the last Imusland in the world. If he does not have a child, the name will die out. And he's telling me that he's been received several handsome offers to be sterilized. I hope he's joking. I hope. But at any rate, I lived with my grandparents, and they really treated me like a little king. You know, things were tough in the Depression. Of course, we didn't know they were tough. I just thought everybody made homemade root beer. My grandma made homemade root beer. You'd buy bottles and buy this junk, and had coils, and could very do it very cheaply. And I go to my grandma and say, "Grandma, I want a bottle of root beer." My grandma said, "Oh, ho, 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 ho. Look at here, he wants some root beer. Here's some root beer, honey." And my grandpa would more say, "And here's some cookies, too." Just take it for granted. When my parents came home on holidays or other times, he just went to hell. "I want some root beer." "Not before dinner, honey." "What do you mean, not before dinner, honey? I want some root beer now." "Not now, son. What do you mean, not now, son? I want some root beer! What? Why don't you go back to where you were? Then when they left later, it gave me a deep sense of rejection. No wonder I'm screwed up. But I've been, you know, the one, you may wonder why victimization is such a wonderful thing. I nourished it for years without being aware of it, and I nourished it before and after I was sober. It's diminished for reasons we all are aware of. You take the extra way and they diminish, but after I was sober for a while, it still had, the victimization is there. And you see all over the country people making millions of dollars peddling this victimization stuff. And these people are, at this convention here, I'm not putting it down at all, but there's only one Al-Anon speaker. All of the rest of them are professionals who are getting paid a lot of money to induce victimization in these people, to sustain and induce it. Now, what's so good about getting victimization? What the hell would make you feel so good? I'll tell you why. Because it does something that nothing else that I know in my life has ever done except alcohol. It removes guilt. Because when it's their fault, it is no longer my fault. I was made this way. All my errors are caused by them, what they did to me. All, even the bad things I do to my children weren't my fault. I was trained this way. I was didn't get nurtured, didn't get loved, on and on and on. And I tell you, guilt is about as painful a memory as there are painful an emotion as I know. I think that's what causes people to commit suicide. And people do a lot of things, a lot of people anyway, the guilt and the conflict, rightfully or wrongfully. And to get rid of guilt, maybe it's worthwhile to become a victim. To get rid of guilt is a great thing. But as I've often said, you know, there are no free lunches in the world. Everything that's any good, there's a tab for. And there's a tab for victimization. You don't really see it at the time, but you can see it in retrospect. One, there's three little price tags that are hooked on victimization. One, you must, without even being aware of it, sustain and enhance resentment towards people who have done it to you. You can say, I forgive them, but deep in your heart you think, why did you do this to me? Why did you do this to me? It really is a resentment disease, victimization. That's why you go to these kind of meetings, these victimization meetings, you don't hear any laughter coming out of these meetings. You don't hear any jokes. You don't see people coming out smiling and feeling good. They're in there reinforcing their own hurt. Second little price tag you have to pay is that you must accept the fact that you are terminally different and there's no way to correct it. I never really understood the depth of that in my own life till I went to a meeting a few years ago with someone who wanted me to go to one of these meetings where they're making a lot of dough by inducing victimizations. I kind of audited the course. I heard this guy give a perfect example. He said, I and you are like trees, that when we were saplings, we were bent and warped. Not killed, just bent. And we've grown up distorted and bent. Now we are, to all intents and purposes, we're big and healthy trees. But we are warped and bent, and no force in the world can make us straight again. Because we have been warped when we should have been straightened. To become terminally different. When you know you're different, you must stay that way forever, and it's not your fault. Which again enhances the resentment towards those who have done it to you. And the third little price tag you have to pay on a continuing basis is one that's quite obvious, because you hear it a lot. You can see it in yourself. I can see it in myself. Intermittent but intense self-pity. Knowing that it wasn't my fault. Why couldn't I have had a decent life? I know everybody else is getting along. My life has been screwed up. And so you wind up with a pretty big price tag to get rid of guilt. But you don't even know you're paying it. All you know is, I hurt a lot and it's not my fault. I spent a lot of money sustaining, and when I see these kind of meetings now, I really wish them well. I wish them well because I think they're going to need all the good wish they can get, because they're going to wind up, if they're like me, thinking they have learned a great deal but living in protracted pain. And I did that for years. And the saving grace in my life, but apparently they don't have, or many of them don't have, the saving grace in my life is that I discovered that alcohol had the power to remove these feelings. Sometimes only temporarily. I didn't make a big deal out of it. I had my first drink on that ship in Pearl Harbor, and I was 15 years old. It's hard for young people to realize that today, but to the best of my knowledge, I haven't been in the same room with a bottle of whiskey at 15 years old. Because Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. I didn't believe, or I was told they didn't. And at that time, I'm sure most of them didn't. But these men had some whiskey in their sea bags, and they intimidated me, this dumb little punk whose work they were doing half the time anyway, because I didn't know anything, intimidated me into taking a drink. And I didn't want a drink. I promised both my mother and grandmother I'd never take a drink of alcohol. But I took a drink of that slop, and it made me throw up, and they laughed at me. And I have very little memory of that, except I can recreate what has to be an almost instant insanity rage. I don't know of any single feeling in my life that is more lethal than that feeling that has come once in a great while when you are, in a sense, publicly humiliated, where you are vulnerable and somebody turns it on you. I would do most, for just a moment, if I had a gun, I'd shoot him. That's to this day why I do not, and I suggest to the people I sponsor, I don't want you to have handguns in your house. Because a couple times in my early sobriety, I saw guys in one of those instant moments, boom, do something that they would never have done if they had to wait 2 minutes. But when that instant insanity comes, and I'm sure most alcoholics in this room must know what that is, doesn't come often. When it comes, it's just, that's why I don't, after all these years, I don't have whiskey in my house. People say, well, if you're going to drink, you're going to drink anyway. That may be. When my daughter got married, I had a lot of champagne served in our backyard. But I kept that champagne in the garage. I don't want it where I can reach it in a moment of insanity. I want it to have to air to hit my face before I get it. And the reason I do that is because a good friend of mine named Eddie Regan, an old-timer that I knew and helped me a great deal, came home from a meeting, tired, a little cross, went in the kitchen, wife grinding him, had poured himself a cup of coffee, and she just said the wrong thing or something had turned on. And he looked up and saw her bottle of whiskey that she drank a little out of once in a while. He said, oh, screw you, bitch! And drank, and that was the end of it. And if he had to go in the next room to get it, he wouldn't have done it. This insanity is a lethal thing, and for me, it isn't there much anymore, but when it comes, it's just, at that moment, I couldn't do anything. These guys were men. I was humiliated, felt bad. I thought later, the only thing I might have done, I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me over the side. But I said, lean over, buddy. Yeah. Take that. Yeah. Give him a zit right in the old eye just to teach him a lesson. But my reaction instead was to sneak into that guy's sea bag every day when nobody was around and take a drink of that crap, and I hated it. But I wanted to be accepted more than I wanted to be worried about being hating that crap. And I throw it up, and I have to wipe it up, and try it next day, and I would throw it up and wipe it up. One day I held a drink down, and it's so terrible I couldn't even breathe. Oh, God, why do people drink that? I can't drink that. And all of a sudden, something strange happened. All of a sudden, I felt significantly better. And I realized why people drink whiskey. If you can still breathe, it makes you feel better. And I didn't think a great deal about that. I didn't, I've heard people in AA say things like, I took that drink and I realized there was a breakthrough in my life and a new form of, not me, it just makes you feel better. I talk about this a lot, talk about it one more time. There's a book out that says, everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten. Not me. I've never learned anything in kindergarten. I had to bring home notes because I wouldn't sleep on my rug. Where you learn life is in your teens. To the best of my knowledge, your body starts to turn, change, and you learn about lust. And then you learn about love. Then eventually you learn, if you're going to have any luck whatsoever, you've got to find a way to disguise lust as love. And you learn that your folks are going to support you the rest of your life when you learn about, you know, on that ship. We were talking about this at dinner tonight. Dick and I were with three wicked women at a table, and they're... I don't judge them, but they're wicked. They smoke cigarettes. But anyway, on that ship, I learned to smoke cigarettes. I didn't know anybody in my family smoked cigarettes, but I learned to... It made me puke. Try it again until finally I could smoke a cigarette. And I got to like him. I smoked 2.5-3 packs a day for the next 45 years, every day. And I, there are still people today, I was telling them to dinner tonight, I guess there are tools of the tobacco industry who would have you believe that smoking doesn't hurt you. And it just makes me very enraged to hear that because, you know, I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day for 45 years, so I smoked a lot. And then I've been in AA a lot of years, and for most of those years, AA was totally smoking. Sometimes you couldn't even see the podium up there. You just suck it in that secondhand smoke and just... And I did all this, and they say it doesn't hurt you. Let me tell you something, folks. It's made me almost completely bald. It's a terrible goddamn habit. I stopped smoking just the nick of time. Look at that, you know. But I learned a lot of those things in that ship, but I didn't pay much sense drinking. Drinking is just something I learned along the way. It makes you feel better. And I drank from then on. Not, I was a classic alcoholic, laying around, falling down, goofy kid here and there, and trying to act like grown-ups, trying to learn to drink stuff that would make me sick and try to do things. And as I say, later in the war, I went in the Navy, and at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California. And they passed out some tests, and I took a test. I've always been good on tests. I can read fast. And they did very, I don't know what it was for, but they turned out, they gave me a high school diploma. And that, I look back at my life now, what a difference that made in my life, because without that, I'd had to go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and start my junior year of high school over again. And I never would have done that in 1,000 years. But instead, I was able to go to college after the war and got married in college, went out in the world. I became a sports writer on newspapers, and I'd married this Catholic girl who had this unfortunate tendency to give birth at the drop of a hat. So I became a national distributor of small Catholics. And so I had to get better jobs, and I got into advertising, and I seemed to have some flair for writing. I became somewhat successful. And all these years I drank. And drinking was no big deal. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. That sounds terrible. I'm sure if you're new to hear somebody say that at a podium, but that's what I believe. Alcohol always made me feel better. Hardly anything ever made me feel better all the time, but alcohol made me feel better. I didn't even pay attention to it. I knew when I need to feel better, I'd have a few drinks. I look back now and I can see what alcohol does for people like me if they have the unnatural reaction to alcohol that I had without ever guessing I had an unnatural reaction. It takes people like me who I guess down deep never feel like they're quite enough for one reason or another, who spend their life pretending they're more than enough a lot of the times so people won't realize they don't feel like they're quite enough, always knowing if people get close to me, they'll realize I'm not enough, so they'll reject me. So one of the things you do is keep people at arm's length, give them a little song and dance, a little pattern, a little soft shoe, or whatever it might be, verbally. Because if they get close, pretty soon you get lonely and you get close, and they don't like you anymore. So you keep them at arm's length. But it takes a person like me who, although I could never thought of it quite this way, but looking back, I can see that I spent my life not feeling I was quite enough. And when I have a few drinks, I feel, at least for a few hours, like I'm more than enough. It just changes everything. That's one of the reasons I drink. It takes a person like me who's lived with fear most of my life, not so much fear of things, but fear of being found out, fear of humiliation, fear of not being accepted, fear of being rejected. And when I have a few drinks, I become fearless for a while. I have fight cops. You want to jump off a balcony into a pool? Shit, let's go. You want to go to Juarez and spend a week? You bet. It It takes a person like me who's always felt rejected, who always, I said, sees rejection, which in turn brings about almost perpetual hurt feelings of one form or another. Always getting my feelings hurt. Always feeling I'm not quite enough. And for a while, I become the rejecter instead of the rejectee. The best example I know of that, I've said it maybe 100,000 times, but I don't know a better way to say it, to demonstrate it. I'm sure you guys in this room have had this feeling. Sitting in a bar late at night, maybe after a tough day and feeling that they're really on to you, and having a few drinks, and watching a miracle, an absolute miracle, take place in front of your eyes. Watching some old beast gradually become beautiful. I might sidle over to such an old queen at closing time. Imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, if she would say, no, I guess if I were sober, I'd hang myself. But of course, I wouldn't be there to ask the question if I were sober. But if I've had a few drinks, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. What a difference that makes in your approach to life, boy. Just a few drinks. Drinking enables me to do all sorts of good things. The only problem I've ever had with drinking is that I have an unfortunate tendency sometimes to drink a little too much. Or after I became aware of my victimization, I realized that many times I have been thoughtlessly overserved. Not my fault. And when I drink too much, I have a tendency to become bizarre sometimes. I didn't know why that was till psychoanalysis. I realized that I, as he explained to me, I was like Prometheus in Greek legend, chained to a rock, rock of repression and repressed psyche. And alcohol broke the chains, and I became free. Perhaps I overdid a little bit. Natural freedom. Remember, it seemed right to me. I never could get a cop to buy that particular argument. Why, I'm like Prometheus, chained to a rock, I'm free off it. Oh, get in the car, you asshole. And so I, eventually some people thought I was not doing very well, and they sent me to an AA meeting. And that was in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. Remember this, you're the most important people, and you're the leaders of tomorrow. And we're really glad we're going to be dead. But I was sent to my first meeting. I was 22 years old, which doesn't seem very young in AA now, but nobody had heard of anybody within 20 years of it then, around that state. And who is this little, I always think about it. It's about the way that I would feel if somebody 7 years old came into AA now. I'm a long-term alcoholic. Yeah, get out of here, you puke. If he's really small, I'd give him a good crack. And they didn't accept me, and I didn't accept them, because it didn't take me long to realize I'm not like these people. These people have problems with alcohol. They get sober, they're all right. I'm not a drinker. I'm intelligent, and unfortunately, I'm cursed with the ability to think. I wish I hadn't. I wish I could be like them. Wish I'd be dumb. I'm sober. I remember after a few meetings, one night, one guy came up to me and said, hey, for Christ's sake, kid, you think you're an alcoholic? And I tried to be honest with him. I said, no, I don't. He said, what the hell do you think's wrong with you? I said, I think I'm too sensitive. And he laughed just the way you laughed. And he called somebody over and told them, and they laughed. And I'll tell you something. I never was honest with anybody else in AA for many, many years after that, because of that same public humiliation. And I want to tell you in passing, that if somebody tells you something dumb, like they're too sensitive, don't laugh, because they may be the first time they're trying to tell the truth for years. They may think that you're really, and they don't understand that you're laughing with them, not at them. All they know is public humiliation again. You'll never get me to tell you how I really feel again. And so I went to AA for a while, then I went to psychoanalysis, and I went to AA from time to time, started getting jams. And in the 1950s, AA was not very well known. It was kind of a mystic thing, and you could, people don't work somehow, and you could tell an employer, well, I'm going to AA. I know I've been drinking too much, but I'm going to go to that AA and go back to AA and come home at night and say, well, to my wife, well, I'm going back to AA. Oh, that's wonderful. That'll be nice. They want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. They had the decency to accept you. Now, for Christ, since the late 1950s, there's never been an arrest for anybody, you know. I mean, they didn't want you to taper off. It's a blah, 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 blah. You're good in denial. Blah, blah, blah. Ah, shut up! You know. But then it was, you could do it. And I went, but AA is always the same thing. AA is a nice place, but it's not for people like me. It's for people who drink too much. Not for people who feel too much or think too much. It's for people who drink too much. And so I had some ups and downs, and sometimes I drank. Sometimes I became kind of successful because I had a kind of a neurotic drive to become successful. I used to think I was great ambition. When I look back now, I see over the years I've worked with some people who've had that same drive. And when I work with someone who's got that drive, I know we're going to have a long, hard spell ahead of us. Because it really is not ambition. It's a neurotic inferiority complex that says, I'm going to do better than you, and I'm going to make you sorry. And there's never enough achievement to sustain that, because there's always somebody else to beat. And so there's never any rest on that one. It's an emotional nymphomania, in a sense. There's never any satisfaction. And but I became somewhat successful. And then when I take my inventory years later, I look back and see I kind of screwed up. I think sometimes, because of my early training, and I believe this to be true, and there's nothing wrong with it, but I believe that I had become guilty enough, despite all my victimizations, down deep inside of me, I knew that I was going to go to hell. I knew what a good person was, and I wasn't that. And all I can think of is that sometimes there are periods when part of my mind would say, subconsciously, of course, you don't deserve to succeed, you bad person. Screw it up. And I don't know if it really happened, but it could very well happen. Just screwed up a lot of opportunities. And drinking helped me, and sometimes I had to quit drinking. But I never quit drinking much. The only time I ever stopped drinking for any length of time, I had a good reason to stop drinking. I took a vow on my son's casket, which is a pretty good way to do it, because I'd been in jail overnight of all nights the night he died. And I always felt so guilty about that. And I took a vow not that it wouldn't happen anymore with my kids. And I was, that time, had just recently gone to Texas. And I was working days at an advertising agency. At night I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. And these kids were moved in, and my wife, and I loved the kids in the abstract, but it was hot, they were noisy, and it was hot and seemed dirty and dry and unpleasant. And I couldn't relate to the people. I just needed to drink so bad I couldn't stand it. Half the time I felt terribly inferior, and half the time I felt superior. And one day I couldn't stand it. One day they went to church, and I just pulled the car in the garage, hooked up a hose, and turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. I couldn't think of a way out, because I couldn't drink under that vow, and I couldn't stand it. I went to AA a couple times in that city just before that, and AA is a nice place, but they have no answer for people like me. They have answer for people who are alcoholic. And I, guy in the next door neighbor watched all this happen, and he noticed I didn't come out the motor running. He came over and pulled me out, and because I was briefly dead, and he beat at my chest, they breathed me and rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and talked to me and determined I was ill and moved me to the psychiatric ward and finally wound up committing me for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas, Now, that's how I get when I stay sober, folks. I'm really not looking for much of it, if you don't mind. In fact, the next year, the next spring, they put in the first experimental alcoholic ward in the state of Texas, and they put it in the Big Spring Hospital. And by that time, I had just come off the shock, electric shock. I had a lot of them because I'd escaped. And I had electric shock, and by this time, my memory was coming back. I remember screwing around AA, so I went to this old alcoholic AA member that ran this ward, and I laid a bill of goods on him, and I eventually got him to transfer me to the alcoholic ward. And eventually, I got out as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But you don't have to be an alcoholic to know what alcoholics like to hear. And after that, I got even a better job. I convinced people I'd change my ways. And I was working in Dallas, working on the ads for the L.C. Delmer, the Borden Cows, if you remember those old things, if you're old enough. And eventually that blew up in my face. And one day I came home and my wife had finally taken the children and left. First time she always left this time. And my pile of clothes in the living room floor. And next thing I knew, I was in jail in Juarez, 600 miles away, 300 miles away. 600 miles away. The next thing I knew, I was in jail in Phoenix. I woke up in the morning, a guy just got done kicking my front teeth out. I was laying on the floor, and he was saying, "You damn drunken, you vomit on my bunk, God damn you." And that morning, I was one of the few mornings I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was so sick I couldn't move my head out of the way of his shoe, but I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And 4 weeks or 5 weeks after that, I woke up one morning, and a guy was throwing me out of a skid row mission in Los Angeles and said, "Stay out of here, you bum." I tried to explain to him, "I'm not a bum. God, 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write are running this very week in Life and Time and Collier's and Zebulon Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair, you know, as you say.